Jeannie Boylan isn't concerned with the beauty of a face. She just wants to get it right. In her memoir, Portraits of Guilt, Boylan chronicles her emergence as America's most innovative forensic artist. She's credited with drawing the only accurate portrait of the Unabomber, and her work, culled only from the memories of eyewitnesses, is often a dead-on picture of a face she's never seen. When Boylan began her work with eyewitnesses, she discovered the standard police method of grilling a witness for details about the criminal's face just wasn't working. One of her first cases was the kidnapping of 12-year-old Polly Klass.
Polly Klass, the case that broke my heart. I dedicated the book to Polly Klass because it's my sincere belief that had things been done a little bit differently in her case, that she would actually be a junior in college at this point. Polly was taken out of her bedroom in Petaluma, California, a stranger abduction. He crawled through a window. Polly was having a slumber party with two other 12-year-old girls when this man walked in and ordered them all to turn face down on the floor and then ultimately ransacked the room, picked up Polly and left. And within about an hour, the police department, local police department, the FBI was in the process of responding, had a forensic artist, their local person, come in who sat the two witnesses down, who were the two little girls, and looked through a book of about 1,000 photographs, trying to pick out features that resembled those that they saw in this suspect. So ultimately, they ended up with a composite drawing that immediately went out. It was known to be a kidnapping right away, so the response was vast. And within about another hour after that, a man named Richard Allen Davis was driving a Pinto, a little Ford Pinto, and he was stuck in a ditch on a rural area on private property. The police were called because he was trespassing, and they came along, stopped their car, and looked in this man's car, and he was belligerent and agitated and sweating and nervous, and they thought that something was wrong, and they ran wants and warrants on him, and they didn't find anything in the car. In fact, what had happened to that point was he had taken Polly out and put her in a ditch about 60 feet away and tied and gagged her. So the police stopped him, looked at him, spoke to him for 38 minutes in full headlights, and determined that there was no reason through the computer system, through wants and warrants, parole, etc., no reason they could detain him any further. So they hooked their car up to his, pulled him out of the ditch, escorted him to the edge of the property, and let him go.
Now, this was after the picture that had been made from the composite had been released, so these police would have seen it by then, and they didn't think there was any resemblance?
Correct. And they went back into their local headquarters at that point and had an opportunity to discuss any potential connection between this composite drawing and the kidnapping, which was in progress. And they determined at that point, because there was such a lack of similarity between the two, the heights were different, the face was different, characteristics were all different, that there was no connection. So they discounted any potential connection, continued on pursuing the investigation. In the meantime, Richard Allen Davis turned around, drove back onto that property after the police had left, retrieved Polly alive at that point from the bushes, and then 6 hours later, or actually 5 hours later, as the sun came up, and he determined that he had great liability by having her in the car with him, and he strangled her, he killed her.
This is standard procedure, what they did with these two little girls. This is the way that people have in this business done this for years.
Correct, and it's still used to this day in preparing these composite drawings. The belief within the criminal justice system is that recall and recognition are two different issues, and that recognition is easier. So if you sit a crime victim down and have them look through, you know, however many photographs, that particular night there were over 1,000 photographs, and they can look at a face and say that the eyes were like this, the nose was like this. It's a very simplistic concept, and it's one that would be effective if it were not for the issue of trauma. When trauma enters into the scenario, it changes the entire dynamic of memory and how memory functions and how information is encoded into recall. When you're dealing with a trauma victim, as those two little girls would be, what happens is that information is encoded into memory more firmly than it otherwise would be, but the emotional element allows for distortion and diffusion. In other words, if you have a trauma victim and they're looking at photographs, the actual image that they remember of the perpetrator, in this case, this kidnapper, is so traumatic to remember and so frightening to remember that the conscious mind will take in any new information that it's presented. So all this visual information that the police are providing are sort of the equivalent of, say you had a murder weapon with fingerprints on it, and then you took that murder weapon and you arrived at the crime scene, found that murder weapon at the scene. Those fingerprints have been placed on that weapon only once, and if smudged, they're gone forever. If you take a memory memory and you add additional images over that, it's the equivalent of taking that murder weapon and adding additional fingerprints over and over and over the top of that original set of prints.
So what do you do when you go in? In this case, when you went in to see Kate, one of, mm-hmm. of the girls, she didn't, from what I've read, she didn't want to talk to you at all. What do you do?
The first thing I do is try to erase any difference between whomever it is that I'm working with and myself. So I don't go in dressed like an FBI agent or like a police officer. In working with a 12-year-old girl, in particular this 12-year-old girl, she was a little tomboy. So I went in a pair of blue jeans and Nikes and a ponytail and a sweatshirt, and I sat down at her level and in a place where she was comfortable and in command, and that's very important. I wanted to meet her on her grounds where she was an authority. So I met her in her home. I managed to convince, through a lot of effort, her parents and her grandparents to leave us alone for a while so she had the freedom to emote. And about an hour and a half into the interview, and I'm talking about all these other topics, and when I would come back around to sort of asking a question that was related to what we were there to accomplish, which was producing the actual image of this suspect, she would sit back in her chair and she would say, now this little girl's genius level IQ, so she was on top of things. And she would sit back in her chair and she'd say, I don't know. I didn't see. I told you I didn't see. I told the police I didn't see. And then I would say, that's okay. Don't worry about it. And well, you know, we move on to other topics. 15 minutes later, I'd come back and ask another question. And I could see that we weren't going to get anywhere. And finally, I just put the drawing board down, open-faced, on the table, because normally they won't see it while I'm working on it because I don't want them dwelling on what we're doing. And so I put the drawing board down. She saw that it was blank, and I leaned back away. I put the pencils down, and I said, you know what, Kate? I'll tell you what, with all that you've been through, if I were you and I had that image in my mind, I wouldn't tell anyone. And she sat back in her chair and she exhaled and she let her arms fall to her sides and she said, yeah, because every time I tell them something, they tell me I'm lying. And what that told me was that she had that image clearly in her mind, but she wasn't going to give it up because she was protecting herself from being accused as a liar again. So once that perspective was validated and understood and she could see that I was on her side, then we began to work together. And ultimately, at the end of that day, and then also interviewing Jillian, the other witness, we ended up with what turned out in the end to be just an absolute mirror image of Richard Allen Davis and radically different than the first drawing that had existed.
Yeah, I understand, I think, how you managed to establish rapport with Kate. What I'm not getting a picture of at all mm-hmm. is how you get the details. What kind of questions do you ask?
Well, what I do is it's a very, very different approach than what the police do. I don't use any visual aids whatsoever to prompt recall because, again, we're dealing with emotion, and I don't want to revive that emotion. So what I try to do is she was very artistically inclined, so I knew going into this that she was very visually inclined. I brought out some Play-Doh and talked about shapes and texture. So rather than saying, you know, when this man walked into the room and held you at knife point, you know, did he have a big nose or round eyes or anything like that, if I phrase the questions in present tense instead of saying was it or did he have, I would say, if you were going to create that kind of a form, now I'm saying that kind of a form or that kind of a shape, I'm not saying anything about the suspect, I'm talking about shapes and forms in present tense. By that point, she's reached over and inevitably this will happen. So that's helping to physically anchor her in the moment, tangibly anchor her. And I'm asking questions like, you know, would you create a shape that's longer than wide or the same length as width? Or, you know, I'm offering options so she's not having to come up verbally with a description.
Now, you said you were personally a victim of an attack, and you've written about this a little. You're talking kind of calmly about it, but it sounds as though that must have been a very important moment in your life that has actually helped you to understand the way in which people are responding to interrogation.
I think so. Having been through the experience, I can understand emotionally what the needs are of someone across the table from a police officer or detective. When I get called in, it's usually by the FBI or it's by a police agency, and it's usually a case that's reached fairly high profile, and it's usually a case where there's an existent drawing and I'm going in to correct it.
Going back to undo some bad work that's been done.
Yeah, I hate to say bad work because people that do this work are really good people with great intentions. There just isn't the training out there for this. The only thing that exists currently are these five-day, I call them the pick-a-nose classes, the matchbook cover classes people fly to, and on Monday they can, you know, barely draw, and on Friday they can, by gosh, they can shade. And so now they're a qualified forensic artist, and that's just ridiculous. What really needs to be done in this industry is to upgrade this to a solid academic foundation because the answers are in psychology. It's how the mind functions, how it encodes and retains information, how trauma affects recall, which is tremendously. I was working with a reporter for a European magazine yesterday that was saying, I couldn't describe my own boyfriend. And I said, well, you know, likely not. But when you have a traumatic circumstance, that information gets encoded. So that's the good news. The bad news is that the emotion can be so intense that it can act to allow the integration of new information, which is what the police currently do comes into play, is how they manage to destroy and damage recall so severely. But they do so without meaning to. So I'm hoping to really not only educate police, but also educate crime victims about how to protect their own recall. That information is intact. When you've been through a traumatic event, it will stay in recall. The longest I've ever worked with someone after a traumatic event was 51 years, and we were able to pull that image up. It's there. But the important thing is that if they can be proactive in protecting it, if police can stop the process they're currently using of bombarding victims or witnesses with these visual elements and mugshots and photographs, and this is what they're currently doing, stop that. And for crime victims to be proactive and say, look, I've got this image intact, and you know, we're not going to tamper with it. I want to be able to identify the person if and when he's caught.
Jeannie Boylan is a forensic artist and the author of Portraits of Guilt. She was named one of Time magazine's innovators in 2001.